offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. In this program, we go through the Bhagavad Gita, verse by verse, with as much detail as we can and with ample reference from Swami's discourses, Swami's writings, especially the Gita Vahini. And in this portion of the Bhagavad Gita, we are speaking about dhyana or meditation. And we've taken a lot of references from Dhyana Vahini, Swami's book, on the subject of meditation. Those of us who are keen on that path, those of us who are keen on that practice, taking it up, I think, to read Dhyana Vahini is a very, very important sadhana in itself. A few years back when we were talking to one of Swami's devotees, who's a very successful businessman, who has a business, it's a multinational business. I think he's one of the most successful entrepreneurs from the country of Japan. In the course of that interview, he had mentioned that he draws a lot of inspiration and he makes a lot of reference to, and also he attributes a lot of his success in the field of business to Swami's Dhyana Vahini. He said it gives him a lot of clarity of thought, the ability to focus, problem solving has become better, and that is the value of Swami's Dhyana Vahini, though it is about meditation. As Swami says, it gives you a better way of looking at life itself. So we had a lot of references, we've been taking a lot of references from Swami's Dhyana Vahini. A few discourses that Swami specifically gave to Swami's students, because as I was mentioning a couple of weeks back, when you come to Swami's fold, there is this urge and desire to please Swami in whatever way that is possible. And we know that trying to take up some sort of spiritual exercise, some sort of sadhana, is one of the ways by which Swami can certainly be pleased. And in the pursuit of trying to do that, a lot of students take to different kinds of sadhanas without understanding completely what they are, how they must be approached. So time and again, Swami would give discourses specifically to students to clarify some of these things. What is meditation? What is Kundalini Yoga? What are the different types of other practices which are there? What are suitable for this time and age, for their age, for their, in the modern context? All of this Swami would give, and I think we made a reference to all of those shlokas. We are continuing in that portion of the Bhagavad Gita in the sixth chapter where Swami is talking about dhyana. But we have already moved to that part where the practice itself is not being described anymore. There are going to be a few verses where summarily Krishna is going to talk about that. But the practical ways which we were referring to of how do you choose a spot, how do you choose a time, how do you prepare the seat, all of that has been covered. We have come past that portion. As always, we'll begin with a short summary of what we covered last time, and that will give us the right backdrop to go through the verses that we have for today. We covered three verses, 19, 20 and 21 last week. As I was just mentioning, in the 19th verse, Krishna begins to speak about the nature of the yogi, nature of the one who has attained the state of yoga through dhyana, not anymore about dhyana per se. So he says, he explains the nature of a yogi's mind by comparing it with a flame of a lamp. To be more specific, he says, the flame of a lamp that is placed in a windless place, nivatastaha, where there is no breeze or there is no wind. The reason for this comparison is, as I was just mentioning, when Krishna was talking about how does one prepare for meditation, there were very different kinds of explanations, instructions which were there, and we went through the explanations. Don't sit too high, don't sit too low, ensure that your seat is made of these things. And we had understood how all of these instructions primarily point towards one thing, that whatever distractions around you can be controlled, control them. and ensure that there are nothing to disturb your mind, disturb your equanimity at that point in time. So that comparison seems to be very good, because now when Krishna is comparing it to placing a lamp in a windless place, I think that can be also compared to controlling all of those distracting entities around you and then sitting for meditation. Of course, we also discussed how this is a very limited analogy, because a yogi's mind, first of all, cannot be described in words and through analogies, and Krishna himself has said that many times. But this idea of comparing the yogi's mind to a flame is not very complete, because from all that we have heard and what we're going to go through in the next few verses that we have for today, we will see that the stability of the yogi's mind is far more than even a flame. Because even if you consider a flame that is in a windless place, we will see that the flame still flickers. And we discussed this last time, how scientifically the fire creates different temperature zones around it, and that causes the air around it to move, and that itself makes the lamp flicker, even if there is no wind around. In that sense, it's a very beautiful analogy, because the mind, even when there are no distractions around, is capable of distracting itself by bringing forth from within some of the memories and thoughts. But when we talk about the yogi's mind, it is far more stable than even that kind of a lamp. Because in the very next shloka, in the 20th shloka, Krishna says, when the mind is restrained, the yogi sees the self by oneself, and because of that, attains perfect calm or quietude. This is the 19th verse, the second line he says this. Whatever has been said in this shloka, 19th and 20th, in the 21st one, Krishna explains this even further. He says, how does the self see the self? By referring to the self as buddhigrahyam and atindriyam, that which is perceived through the buddhi and that which is beyond the senses. He makes it very clear that when you say that atmani atmanam pashyanna, when he says one sees one's own self, the seeing is not through the eyes, the seeing is not even through the mind, but it is through the buddhi which is the amsha of the atma which is there in each one, which can differentiate between what is nitya and anitya, what is eternal and what is ephemeral. Through that buddhi, this atma is seen. So that is, he makes a point of that. And when the self recognizes one's own self, when the yogi sees one's own self, it is not like any other form of seeing. We discussed it based on one seeing one's own self in the mirror. That experience is completely different. And once one sees this true self, the nature of the true self is recognized as one's own self. The Atma's nature is Sat Chit Ananda. And seeing the self means you recognize that Sat Chit Ananda is your own nature. And this leads to Sukham Atyantikam, infinite bliss, because now you recognize your nature itself to be Ananda, right? Similarly, one recognizes one's own nature to be Sat or Truth. Because of that, one does not waver from that truth anymore. Na chalati tattvataha. So these were the verses that we went through last week, and as I was just telling you, these descriptions are going to continue even this week, where Krishna is going to speak about the nature of the yogi who has reached that state. In fact, there's going to be a very beautiful definition of yoga itself, just to give you a prelude of what is coming. But this entire portion, what we're going to discuss today, what is going to come in probably the next 10 shlokas, I should say, are very similar to what we have come across already. It's going to be repetitive. I'm going to give you that warning already. Not much of what is going to be said is going to be fresh or new. So the attitude with which we have to go through the next few shlokas, in my opinion, as I'm going through it, this is what strikes me and I'm sharing it with you, is that even though we know this, even though we have heard it, don't look forward for something fresh, but look forward to something that is worth contemplating upon. We listen to the news every day, we listen to statistics, we listen to all kinds of information that we cannot do anything much about. We only feel sad, we only feel despondent, we feel fear, but there is nothing that we can do about it. But still we keep listening to it over and over again, we keep reading about it over and over again, we keep discussing with each other, and we only become more and more anxious. But what we are speaking about here is the truth, is what has to be contemplated upon, what is meant to be constantly rolled in the mind. One has to perform the act of mananam. Constant contemplation has to be done on these. So let us approach it in that manner, because that also has a very important relevance. I will mention that also as we go into the program. But we'll begin as always by listening to the shloka itself, the 22nd shloka of the 6th chapter. It's rendered beautifully by Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it in his voice. I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail what is the inner meaning of the shloka.
Yam ladhva cha param labham manyate nadhikantatah yasmin sthito na dukhena gurunapi vichalyate.
Which, having obtained, he thinks there is no other gain superior to it. Wherein established, he is not moved even by heavy sorrow. That is the 22nd verse of the 6th chapter. As I mentioned, from the 21st verse, or even from the 19th verse, where Krishna gives the analogy of the lamp, Krishna has already started talking about the one who has reached the goal of dhyana, not merely the practice of dhyana. And this description, as we will be seeing, is just very similar. Why did I just say before playing that shloka that some of this is going to be repetitive? Because it'll be very similar to what Krishna said in the portion about karma yoga. Because when he was talking about a karma yogi who has become perfect in karma yoga, or when he was talking about a sthita prajna, one of steady knowledge, or what Krishna is going to be talking when he's going to talk about a bhakta, a devotee, and one who has attained perfection in that path. All of this is going to be very similar. What Krishna is going to say in the next few verses will be similar to all of this, because this is the basic tenet of Sanatan Dharma, that all paths lead to the same goal. The state one reaches is very similar, right? But for us, these descriptions will be, even though repetitive, will always bring some kind of something new to learn, or something new to contemplate about, or some new angle to look at the same thing that we are talking about. And we will see that even today. The first thing that Krishna says in this particular shloka is, yam labdhva cha, and having attained this, he's talking about the state that has been described in the previous verse, and the verse before that, where he said, you attain infinite bliss, you attain quietude, you do not swerve from that. We will find that what Krishna is saying here is also a description of why one does not swerve from that state once it is reached. So he says, yam labdhva cha, and having attained this, Krishna had said, na chalati tattvatah, he does not swerve from tattva in the state. So Krishna is speaking about that state. Yam labdhva cha, and having attained that state, manyatena, does not consider and does not think, aparam labham, any other gain, adhikam tataha, to be greater than this. If you were to look at our own life, our own approach to life, constantly we give up what we already have in pursuit or in trying to gain something else. This may be a physical thing, or it could be a concept or an idea. Physical thing, I'm living in a house. I desire for a bigger house. I already have a car. I want a more luxurious car. And having had that desire, we work towards it. And eventually we give up what we already have. We give up the smaller house, a smaller car, and move into the bigger house or start using the more luxurious car. But if you were to say that sometimes people have to move into smaller spaces too, right? Let's say that you've had financial troubles, you had to give away something that you had which was more luxurious or more larger, and you had to move into a smaller house. If you observe it, even then you are moving from one state to another, you're giving up one state and you're going to a better state. In this case, from a state of unaffordability, you're moving to a state of affordability, right? That's what happens when you have financial troubles and you're trying to live within your means. Materially, it may be a loss, but it is still, in a certain sense, a gain, right? And this aspiration for something more than what we already have will never cease, because we are internally in search of happiness and we are eternally in search of peace. But technically speaking, there must be some point beyond which there is no seeking. Oftentimes when you look at how the field of physics works, or how some of these mathematical models work, beyond a point, you cannot practically create a model for a concept that you're talking about, especially when you're talking about quantum models or when you're talking about algorithms. Sometimes to recreate machines that are able to do algorithms the way you have conceived, right now we don't have the technology to give that kind of power and processing power and all of that. So most often what do? They do a thought experiment, that if we were able to create a model that can do this, what will be the results, right? So in a similar manner, we are constantly seeking happiness, we are constantly seeking peace, and we have found happiness. It's not that we all are not happy. To a certain extent, we have found it, but we are seeking for something more. So even if we were to imagine, do a thought experiment, that there must be a state where you will not seek anything more, right? As Krishna says here, yam labdhva cha aparam labham manyate na adhikam tataha. Having reached that state, you will feel there is nothing more to achieve. We have this feeling many times in life. You know, let's say I just have to, I've fallen in love with somebody, I just have to get married to this person. Then my life will be made. Or I just have to get admission into this B school. Then my life is made. I just have to become a doctor. Or parents think that somehow let's work hard, do whatever it takes and make my son or daughter an engineer. That's all I need to do to settle peacefully in life. But what makes that sense of fulfillment not last? It could be a small restlessness that comes out of jealousy when you look at somebody who's better off, somebody who's having something that you don't have, right? You could be a very rich and very well-endowed person, but then you see somebody who's working for you, who's earning one-tenth of what you earn, but is having a lot of family time, who's enjoying something. You look at that person and there is a longing. Oh God, I made so much money, but I don't have what simple joy that person is experiencing, right? This is just a small restlessness that you feel. It cannot be even categorized as jealousy, right? It is not even a negative emotion, but something that you lack when you see with some other person, it creates a certain restlessness within, which is born out of comparing with another person, or some sort of dissatisfaction. Even though you set a target for yourself, you set a goal for yourself, you achieve it eventually, But then you find that that fulfillment doesn't last. So starting from something which is like a small restlessness that is born out of comparison to a great misery or a great disaster that when you feel in life, a great sorrow, that can also make you feel absolutely disillusioned with what you already have. Take the example of Arjuna himself. Imagine, who would not like to be Arjuna? Imagine Arjuna as a personality. Imagine Arjuna as a person in your office, or a person who's a classmate in your college or your university. Imagine Arjuna in a role like that. Arguably the best archer of his time. He's a master of all his arts, right? He's a master of music. He's a master of dance. He beats all the kings and princes in the land and then wins Draupadi's hand. So he's like, so many people are jealous of what he's been able to accomplish. And wherever he goes, he's a star. And imagine the Lord comes down in the human form as Krishna. Krishna comes to the Pandavas and he becomes dearest to Arjuna. Arjuna becomes his closest comrade. Imagine we all have come across some one person in our classroom or one person in our neighborhood who's like getting everything right? Everything, he's good looking, he's talented, he's got everything going in life, he's got a good job, his house is beautiful, his children are very nice. Imagine even Arjuna, who's probably a quintessential representation of that desirable state. But Arjuna is unhappy. He's struck by sorrow, isn't it? And he's struck by sorrow in such a manner that whatever achievements that he has, nobody can take away the fact that Arjuna is a supreme warrior. Nobody can take away the fact that Arjuna is such a phenomenal personality, that he has achieved so many things, that he is, his fame is spread all over the Bharatvarsha. None of this can be taken away, but when sorrow strikes him, he doesn't find happiness and fulfillment in any of these achievements, right? In the past few years, in my interaction with many of the devotees, especially as part of the Answering Booth program, or whenever we get to meet some of the devotees, we tend to meet some people who have unfortunately gone through terrible disasters in their life. If we were to pay attention to some of these sorrows that we experience, and it sometimes is very difficult to pay attention or to contemplate on or think deeply about sorrow when we are going through sorrow. We will talk about that when we're doing the next shloka. But if we are able to look keenly into sorrow, just like how we look keenly into happiness itself, there is so much that we can learn from that. Sometime back I met a mother who had lost a very brilliant son. He was a teenager, he was an overachiever for his age, he'd done some fantastic things, and due to a small disaster, the parents lost him. He died at a very young age. Imagine this husband and wife, the parents of this promising young teenager, are very successful professionals. They moved to the US, they had an ambition for themselves, they became very successful. They made a lot of money, name and fame. But do you think any of this would have mattered to that mother when she was grieving about her son? Years and years of ambition, the immense joy of achieving much of it, and sometimes I think they achieved much more than they had even set out to achieve. But suddenly all of that feels meaningless when sorrow strikes you, isn't it? You still have the money, the position, achievements, but the joy associated with that seems to have simply vanished. Even though everything is there, even though, when you thought that if I get $1 million, I'll be happy and my life will be settled, you have $1 million, but the joy is gone when sorrow strikes you in some form like this, right? So this itself shows that where is that happiness actually coming from? Isn't it coming from within? It is not exactly associated with any of the objects outside. Happiness is felt in the mind which is within. And that happiness is based on a few thoughts that we have within us. The feeling of mind. any teenager dying does not cause this kind of sorrow. But because that teenager happens to be my son, the sorrow seems to completely consume me, right? So where is this idea that so-and-so belongs to me, so-and-so is mine, come from? It is again in the mind, right? I'll just repeat that again because this is very, very important. If objects outside can make us happy, then as long as those objects last, the happiness must last. I've made $1 million, I've got a huge house, I've got these all these luxuries. If my happiness can come from that, as long as I have that big house, as long as I have that bank balance, I should be happy. But when a sorrow comes along, the happiness is taken away, that is a sign that the happiness does not lie outside, it lies within the mind, right? That is the first step of understanding. But how is the sorrow able to hit? How is the sorrow able to take away the sense of fulfillment and happiness? It is because this mind has a sense that I am so-and-so, I belong to these people, so-and-so belong to me, this is my family, this is my son, or this is my property, or whatever it is, right? So the happiness is felt within the mind. The happiness is taken away also because of certain concepts that are held in the mind. Imagine in the past when long distance communication was possible only through post. We never had these telephones, and even trunk calls came much later, when I think a little earlier than my childhood probably. But there was a time when the only way to communicate was by sending letters, right? If someone was living abroad and say that person passes away, it used to take sometimes few weeks or even few months for the news to reach the family. That being the case, you know, the dear one may be dead for many, many days, but the family will be happy here till the news reaches them. When it comes to their awareness, they begin feeling sad. So what happens outside is never the cause of sorrow and joy. Our idea that so-and-so belongs to me, or I can be happy only when I possess this, coupled with our awareness, is what brings this sense of happiness in the mind, or the sense of sorrow in the mind. Because for months the dear one has passed away, but I have not come to know of it. But the moment I come to know of it, then I start feeling sad. So my awareness, the thought or the situation coming into my consciousness, plus these concepts and ideas that I have of who I am, this is what creates happiness, this is what creates sorrow, and it is within the head, it is within the mind, it is not outside. Another example I can think of is, you know, when you write an exam, the teacher is evaluating it, and let's say that she has given you the first rank, but till the results are announced and till you come to know about the results, you will be anxious about it, right? You've already got the first rank the moment the teacher has corrected your paper and put your marks on that sheet. But till the whole thing is processed and the results are out and you are able to go and see the results and then realize that you've passed or you've got first rank, your happiness is not yours because it has not come to your knowledge that this event has happened outside, right? So both happiness and sorrow is in the mind. It is in my awareness and the ideas and concepts that are held in the mind. It is not outside. But what happens outside makes me feel happy in the mind. And just like how we distinguish between this outside and inside, if we were to really think deep, we will see that what happens in the mind also does not really affect us. Our true nature is ananda, our true nature is truth. But for that one, for this idea, for this recognition, I mean, just what I told you about what happens outside does not really change your happiness, but what happens inside your mind, what thoughts happen inside the mind is what causes happiness and sorrow. This distinction between outside and inside can be made with a little bit of thinking. But this distinction of what happens in the mind and what happens even deeper than in the mind. That understanding needs a little more thinking, a little more contemplation, right? That doesn't come as easily. And that is why this is, all of these are repeated so many times, and I'm sure we have spoken before also about sorrow. We've spoken about happiness before. Why is it important to keep repeating this all the while again and again to ourselves? Because this does not come naturally to us, and it helps us be constantly thinking about this, right? So this has to be examined, this experience has to be examined with the buddhi, right? It's not merely about the mind, but the intellect, the spiritual buddhi, as Swami would say. There's this very beautiful conversation in one of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, between sage Yajnavalkya and his consort, Maitri. Swami has also mentioned this in many of his discourses and in his writings. There is the sage Yajnavalkya, we all know, one of the great sages of Bharat. After a certain point, the sage wishes to take sannyasa. He wants to put an end to his grihastha and vanaprastha stage and become a sannyasi. So he calls his wife. He actually has two wives, Maitri and the other one has slipped my mind. He has two wives. So he calls them and he says that I would like to end this grihastha phase and become a sannyasi. And so he decides that whatever property he has, because he has earned a lot of wealth through his scholarship, he decides to distribute it between the two of them. Katyayini, I think. The second wife's name is Maitri and Katyayini. He calls Maitri, and Maitri is the wiser one of the two. And he tells her that, you know, this is what is my plan, so please permit me to leave, because that was the rule those days. You had to take the permission of the wife before you enter into sannyasa. So he tells her, please permit me to take leave of you and take up sannyasa. And he says, I will distribute the property between the two of you. And she asks a very, very beautiful and deep question. He says, if I were to have all the wealth of the world, do you think it will give me immortality? The idea is, she says, will the happiness that I get out of the wealth that you are offering me, will it be eternal? Will it be ever stable and ever with me? And Yajnavalkya tells her, it will not. It can merely only give you some comfort. It cannot give you immortality. It cannot give you unending happiness. Then Maitri tells, who was a very, very wise woman, Swami would say that she is a representation of the great women of the past who attained Brahmajnana. So Maitri says, what is the point of this wealth that you're offering to give me then? The very fact, of course, she doesn't say this. Now here is Yajnavalkya, who is ready to give up all this wealth and go away. Why would he give up this wealth and go away? As I just mentioned in the previous one, if there is a labham or a gain that is greater than what I already have, then I will give up this and go for something else. And that is what Yajnavalkya is doing. He's saying this material wealth is useless. I am after a gain that is much greater. So he is giving up this wealth and going in search of true knowledge. So here is his wife who is asking, you are giving it up knowing well that this is not going to give you eternity, this is not going to give you immortality, this is not going to give you constant happiness. Then what use is it for me? Why are you giving it to me? Right? So she looks at her husband and says, what is the point of this wealth that you're offering me? Today you will give me this wealth, but at some point death will take it away from me, or some kind of disturbance might take it away from me. Instead, share with me what you know. Share with me the knowledge of immortality. That is the property I want you to give me. Right? And Yajnavalkya is extremely pleased with this question and then goes on to explain the nature of life, nature of happiness, of love and attachment and the self. So we are talking about this knowledge that dismantles the vrittis in the mind. Vrittis are thoughts, vrittis are concepts, are ideas. So the knowledge which dismantles all of these vrittis, that cause happiness, that cause the happiness to go away. That is why one of the previous shlokas Krishna says that Atmana Atmanam Pashyanna. When in this manner you see the self, see for yourself the self, the ideas get removed from the mind, the ideas of me and mine, the ideas that the society puts into our mind, that you cannot be happy if you do not have a house like this, you cannot be happy if you do not achieve such and such a thing, you cannot be happy if people do not praise you in this manner. All of these are concepts and ideas that have been put from outside within our head and coupled with our idea of, all of these thoughts, mine and thine, and the objects that we try to gather, all of this together create happiness and sorrow and happiness and sorrow. Right? In the second line of this particular verse that we are going through, Krishna says, Yasmin sthitaha, in which state when established, na dukhena, no sorrow, gurunapi, however immense, vichalyate, moves it from the state. Very beautifully explains that. He says you reach a state where no sorrow, right? As I said, it could be a small disturbance, it could be a small restlessness, to immense sorrow of losing a dear one or having a disaster by which you lose everything that you have. Even the greatest of sorrow, Gurunapi, he says, na dukhena gurunapi, however immense that sorrow can be, vichalyate, it is not moved by it. Why is this happiness moved? Why is this state of happiness unsettled? Because something will come into our consciousness and disturb it, right? Some small dissatisfaction or some massive sorrow, as I just mentioned. In our naivety, what do? Most of us in the worldly life, what do? We try to gather something which we think can be a solution to all of this. And in our limited understanding, we run after money. Because it seems like one of the common transactionable commodities which can address all of the crises that we are likely to face in life. The crisis of health, the need for education, the need for comforts. This seems like one thing that will settle all of this, right? But at some point, as we just saw, the grief comes and shakes you. And that is because we have all of these ideas of limitedness within ourselves. And jnana or knowledge dismantles this thinking, and the true source of bliss is recognized as being within and not in the objects outside. The true source of happiness is recognized within, and it is preserved by removing these thoughts of so and so belongs to me, or I am this body, or I belong to this family, or this family belongs to me. As I mentioned right in the beginning, sorrow plays a very important role in the spiritual journey. There is no better indicator than sorrow to assess our own progress. That is why Krishna describes the state of happiness as one that cannot be shaken by the heaviest of sorrows. The ultimate happiness, the ultimate peace that he is talking about, cannot be shaken by the heaviest of sorrows. In fact, he reiterates this in the next shloka as well, where he continues to speak about sorrow. We'll listen to that, the 23rd verse, and we'll discuss about that.
Tam vidyat dukha sanyoga viyogam yoga sanghitam sanishchayena yoktavyo Yogo nirvinna chetasa.
One should know that severance of contact with sorrow to be what is called yoga. That yoga has to be practiced with perseverance and with an undepressed heart. There are some very important points being made here in the 23rd verse of the 6th chapter. The most important and relevant to what we've been discussing so far is the role of sorrow. Apart from that, of course, Krishna gives a beautiful and new definition for yoga, which is again based on sorrow. So we'll look at all of that. I think till now in all the shlokas, if we were to make a list of the various words that have been used and that have been repeated many, many times, one of the words would be yoga, right? It is many, many times mentioned in the shlokas itself, and in our trying to understand and speak about it, we keep using that word ever so more often. And as we have already seen, this word yoga is used in different contexts too. The word yoga itself can be said to have three different meanings, really. And we will find that it's a very beautiful word, very complex word. Many times I've said this, the word yoga comes from the root word that means to unite or to yoke. But according to Panini, one of the greatest Sanskrit grammarians, the root word for yoga, which is yuj, right? The word yuj itself has three meanings. The first one, he says, yuj samyamane, to restrain or to control is yuj. So if you talk of yoga having the root word as yuj and using this meaning, yoga means to have self-control or to have self-restraint. That is why Patanjali defines yoga in a statement that we've heard Swami quoting so many times. Yoga is chitta vritti nirodhakaha, to control and completely sublimate all the vrittis in the mind is yoga. And this definition comes from yuj samyamane. Yuj means to control. The second interpretation is yuj samadhau, to concentrate, to meditate. So yoga also means to concentrate on something or to remain focused on something. And finally, yujir yoge, to unite or to yoke, is also yuj. So yoga is also being in a state of being connected to something, or trying to connect or hold on to something, is also referred to as yoga. As we can see, yoga is used in all these contexts in the Gita. And that is why it is a very potent word. To remain in the state of unity is yoga. So in that sense, yoga is the goal. To concentrate or focus on the goal or self is also yoga. So defining one's goal in life is also called yoga. Practice of self-control is also referred to as yoga. So in that sense, the path to reach the goal is also yoga. And that is why we have repeatedly karma yoga, sankhya yoga, bhakti yoga. Because the path is also defined as yoga. The goal is also defined as yoga. Setting the goal is also defined as yoga. And that's the reason why Swami would often say, to think that yoga is nothing but a set of physical exercises or asanas is completely wrong understanding. Right? But coming back to the meaning of yoga, so yoga is that word that stands for all of this. And in whatever way we look at it, being focused on or attached to a higher goal, be it God or one's own self, is one of the meanings that is always applicable. Whatever we are speaking, it is always applicable as being focused on or being attached to something that is higher. You can attach one to another. You can join one entity to another entity. But you can do that only when there are two entities, isn't it? But now if you look at the ultimate state is always spoken of as being oneness. So using the same word which means to attach, now Krishna defines that state as being irreversible. That is, once the sadhaka reaches the state of yoga, there is no detaching from it. And as we saw in the previous shloka, what removes us from this happiness? We have attached ourselves to the self, but what removes us from this attachment? Any small disturbance, or any large disturbance, which is all termed under this word dukkha. So if we were to see the sequence, the way Krishna is explaining this whole thing in the past few shlokas. First Krishna says, sukham atyantikam, infinite bliss is reached. Then he says, that he remains fixed in that state. Stitaha. He stays established. Na chalati tattvataha. Does not waver from the truth. Why and how he doesn't waver? He said in the previous verse, yam labdhva chaparam labham manyate nadikam tataha. Because now he does not find any other labham or gain to be greater than what has already been achieved. What makes us feel that some other gain is better or what someone else is having is better? It is some restlessness or some sorrow that can be created by seeing that. So Krishna says in the previous shloka, yasmin stito na dukkhena gurunapi vichalyate. Even a heavy sorrow does not shake this person. So the attachment is so much that no sorrow can shake it. The source of stability and focus and of control is defined on the basis of sorrow. Krishna makes it further clear in the shloka. He says, tam vidyat, let it be known that dukkha samyoga viyogam yoga sangitam. Yoga sangitam. It is known as yoga, which is dukkha samyoga viyogam. Again, playing with the meaning of the word yoga, which means to be attached. Krishna says, dukkha samyogam. It means to be attached to sorrow. Dukkha samyogam means to be attached to sorrow. Dukkha samyoga viyogam means severance of this attachment to dukkha is yoga. The word viyoga is the opposite of yoga. Yoga means to attach. Samyoga, he says, is to attach. Viyoga is to detach. It means to cut off. So dukkha samyoga means a state of being in touch or attached to sorrow. Dukkha samyoga viyoga means to be cut off from that nature we all have right now of being attached to sorrow. So dissociation from the association with sorrow is yoga. Right, that is the meaning of that beautiful phrase that he makes there. Dukkha samyoga viyogam yoga sangitam. That is known as yoga, which is dissociation from association with sorrow. So Krishna is defining yoga as being attached to oneself, attaching oneself to the real self, but also detaching oneself from all sorts of dukkha or sorrow. When we spoke about Dhyana Yoga, we were referring to the practice of meditation, where for few moments of the day we try to remove the idea that we are this body and we are this personality, and then we try to immerse ourselves in the true self or God. So this yoga is having, this Dhyana Yoga, the practice of this Dhyana Yoga is having one foot here and one foot there. This is only a practice of focus and restraint. But the ultimate state of yoga is you have completely detached from all sorts of sorrow. And that is because you have perceived with your buddhi the true self. Yatra chaivatman atmanam pashyannatmani tushyati. This was what he said in the 20th verse. Having seen the self oneself, he draws all happiness from within. So this dukkha samyoga viyogam will eventually happen. It will happen automatically when the vision of the self is had. That's what Krishna says here, right? When one sees one's own self, atmani tushyati. Right, that's what he says. You will derive all your satisfaction and happiness from the Atman. So this will eventually happen, right? When you are able to find all happiness within, you are completely detached from anything that can cause sorrow from outside. But every description that Krishna gives is also something to be contemplated upon, right? That's why I said, even though it is repetitive, it is very important. And we see this trend repeatedly in the Gita when Krishna spoke about the jnani in Karma Yoga part. They were all pointers for the sadhaka. Those are all things that the sadhaka can contemplate upon or practice. Same is the case here. when I have the vision of the Atma, I will automatically detach from all worldliness and sorrow that comes from it. But it is specifically mentioned here because it can be contemplated upon, it can be practiced, it can become a part of one's sadhana. And that is what precisely Krishna mentions in the very next line of the shloka. He says, Sa nischayena yoktavyo yogo. Sa yogaha. That yoga of detaching from sorrow, which Krishna mentioned in the previous line, yoktavyaha, has to be practiced or has to be strived for. Nischayena, with determination, with resolve, right? That's what he says, Sa nischayena yoktavyo. This yoga has to be practiced with a resolve. So here again, Krishna speaks of yoga as a practice. Yoga as a means of controlling oneself and focusing. But what he says next is even more interesting. He says that yoga has to be practiced with resolve. And he says, Anirvinnam Chetasa. Anirvinna Chetasa. With a mind that is not despondent or gloomy. The mind should be cheerful and positive. Though sorrow is a very good indicator and very important in understanding yoga, Vedanta cannot be simply used as a quick fix at times of sorrow. Though there is a very important and a clear, there's a very clear connection between sorrow, happiness and yoga and Vedanta, Vedanta cannot be used, this knowledge cannot be used at a time of sorrow as a quick fix. When the mind is hopeful and the mind is not despondent, when the mind is not low or at least not under enormous grief, these have to be contemplated upon. Where does sorrow come from? What is the source of happiness? What is the source of fear? These things have to be contemplated on. And that is what Yajnavalkya tells Maitri in that conversation in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. He says, when she says, give me that which will make me immortal, the sage says, contemplate on the self as the source of everything, as the source of all your joy, as the source of all your love. Whatever you see, whatever you experience, everything is the self. He says, contemplate on this truth. And this knowledge is what will give you immortality. Now, when Krishna started speaking about dhyana, we had discussed this. Dhyana is to attain atma-samyama or absolute self-control. That's why this chapter is also called atma-samyama yoga. Even though absolute self-control is the goal of dhyana, but even to start practicing dhyana, you need a certain amount of self-control. One has to be a yati or a person of self-control, right? In the same way, dhyana gives one absolute purity. Even then, to start this sadhana, one needs a certain purity of mind. The purity that is achieved at the end of dhyana is the purity from raga and dvesha, the freedom from raga and dvesha. But the prerequisite purity, as we discussed, is to lead a moral life, to lead a life without harming anybody. In the same manner, this yoga will lead to sukamatyantikam, infinite happiness. But even to perform this yoga, you need a certain amount of happiness. Anirvinna chetasa, you need a mind that is not downcast, not despondent, which means you need to be, to a certain extent, you need to be cheerful and hopeful, right? So this is a very important thing that Krishna is saying here. That sorrow is, first of all, something that actually detaches you from that state of happiness. And the best way to qualify your state of, whether you are really in that ultimate state or you are progressing towards that state is, how much is sorrow able to disturb you, right? There's another very beautiful analogy that Swami gives. I think we don't have enough time to go to the next shloka, so I'll just spend a little more time on what Swami says here as Dukkha Samyoga Viyogam. Swami gives this beautiful analogy, and Swami would specifically say this to all of our students. All the wisdom that Swami gives, especially when we are in Swami's presence and Swami's university, Swami would say is like pure milk. But the moment we complete our course or during vacations or whatever, when we have completed our stay with Swami, we go back to our homes, we take up a job, we start going into the world. Swami says this pure milk will get diluted with water, which is the worldliness that comes from the world. Swami would say, however pure and nourishing the milk that I give may be, because it is the purest, it is coming right from the source, when mixed with water, it will get diluted. So Swami would say, what you must do is, before you start mixing with the world, which is like mixing milk with water, Swami would say, churn this milk. Make this milk into whatever is that process, make it into curd, make it into buttermilk, and eventually you make butter out of it. And once you make butter out of it, Swami would say, then you can put it in water. It will never dilute, it will not mix with it, it will start floating on that water. So Swami says a very similar thing is being conveyed in this example that is given, right? In the shloka that we just discussed. When we say dissociate from the association with sorrow, it is nothing but dissociate from samsara, dissociate from the world, right? As it is said, whether we know it or not, we are the pure Atma. But this Atma gets attached to what is anatma, what is illusory. And the glue that attaches this pure eternal Atma to the illusory temporary anatma is avidya. And because of this association, there is sorrow and there is suffering and there is happiness also, but then that happiness is short-lived. Only vidya or knowledge can dissolve this adhesive of avidya, which makes us associate with anatma. That is why yoga is not merely being established in the Atma. It can equally be described as disconnecting or viyoga from dukkha, which is an illusion. The next few verses, I think right up to the 33rd verse, when Arjuna asks a question, Krishna is going to describe what happens when one achieves this yoga and what is the nature of one who has achieved it. And again, these are all descriptions which are for the sadhaka so that one can contemplate on and one can practice on. And these are very important things, as I've been saying so many times, it is repetitive. But when the mind constantly associates with these truths, what is the source of sorrow? Where does sorrow come from? Where does happiness come from? The thinking in the mind slowly will change. The way we will look at objects outside will definitely change over a period of time. When there is a disaster, the way you look at it will change. In fact, I can guarantee this, that if we constantly contemplate on all of these truths, we can see a marked difference in the way we react to changes outside. Things that others get elated about, others get depressed about, the way we react to that will be different. The way things that make others extremely anxious, the way we will look at it will be completely different. And that will happen only through this process of Shravana, Manana and eventual Nididhyasana, right? And that is why I think that's the only reason why Krishna probably is repeating all of these things again and again, right? Otherwise you don't need 700 verses to convey all of this. I mean, I'm not saying that Krishna is being verbose, but I'm saying that there is a definite purpose why these concepts are constantly being repeated, and we will go with it. As Krishna is repeating, we will also repeat it for our own benefit, for our own contemplation, so that this slowly, as I just mentioned, this vidya will eventually dissolve this adhesive of avidya, which makes us associate with anatma, and then we will recognize ourselves as atma. Right, because yoga as much is dissociation or viyoga from illusion as much as it is yoga to the truth. So with that, dear listeners, we'll conclude this week's episode. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's Lotus Feet. Do join me again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. Till I meet you all next week, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.